From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, two-thirds of the rock group Crosby, Stills, and Nash. David Crosby and Graham Nash tell us how they met and why they still make music together. Also today, we meet comedian Tommy Davidson. He plays lots of characters on the TV show In Living Color. Now he gets to play himself in his own comedy special. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new solo album from Jeff Lynne, formerly of the Electric Light Orchestra and the Traveling Wilburys. And Leslie Savin looks at Madison Avenue's attempts to cash in on the end of the Cold War. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The NATO summit has concluded in London with a wide-ranging package of changes in the alliance's doctrine that amounts to a declaration of peace with the Soviet Union, NPR's Mike Schuster reports.
On the initiative of the United States, NATO has adopted changes in virtually every important aspect of its doctrine: nuclear strategy, weaponry, troop deployment, and the future security framework of a transformed Europe. For the first time, the alliance has declared its nuclear arsenal weapons of last resort. It has called for a declaration of non-aggression with the Warsaw Pact. It has invited Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev to visit the alliance's headquarters in Brussels, and it will welcome liaison missions from its former adversaries of Eastern Europe. NATO is also calling for accelerated arms control talks in Europe to reduce conventional and short-range nuclear weapons. NATO leaders called the summit a turning point, and the alliance's Secretary General said the meeting was its most important in its 41-year history. I'm Mike Schuster in London.
President Bush and Japanese Prime Minister Toshiki Kaifu will meet tomorrow in Houston to go over strategy before next week's economic summit. Japan's foreign ministry says the two leaders will try to coordinate their positions on aid to the Soviet Union and China. The U.S. and Japan both oppose extensive financial aid to the Soviet Union. Prime Minister Kaifu hopes to persuade President Bush that it's time to resume formal contacts and extend economic assistance to China. The president will also brief Mr. Kaifu on the results of the NATO summit. Louisiana Governor Buddy Romer made good on a pledge to veto a controversial abortion bill today. He objected to it because it made no exception for a pregnancy caused by a rape or incest. NPR's John Burnett reports.
Today's promised veto of the abortion bill kicks off a pitched battle to override that veto, which requires a two-thirds vote in each chamber. Abortion rights advocates point out that never in this century have legislators successfully overridden the veto of a Louisiana governor. But they worry that Romer has been one of the weakest governors in years, and he won't be able to muster the support to block it. Anti-abortion forces will rally their followers for demonstrations and lobbying of the 144 lawmakers. The law, if passed, would be the toughest, indeed the only abortion ban in the country, and it would invariably go to the Supreme Court. It outlaws any abortions except to save the life of the mother and sentences doctors who perform abortions to 10 years at hard labor. The Louisiana legislature adjourns at midnight Monday. In Baton Rouge, this is John Burnett reporting.
17 people were killed and at least two injured last night in Channelview, Texas, when an explosion and fire tore through a city block-sized section of a chemical plant. Witnesses said the blast was like a rocket taking off. It sent a fireball 200 feet into the air and broke windows up to several miles away. Stock prices turned upward again today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 26 points to close at 2,904.95. This is NPR News. Police in South Africa say a bomb exploded today at a crowded bus terminal in a black section of Johannesburg, injuring at least 27 people. It was the sixth and most serious bombing in Johannesburg this week. Authorities suspect it to be the work of white extremists who've claimed responsibility for the earlier bomb attacks. The African National Congress charged that ultra-right-wing and neo-fascist groups are on a rampage and called on the government to disarm and disband the groups. Today's bomb went off at a crowded bus station during the morning rush hour. Curators at the Louvre Museum in Paris today announced that a dozen pieces of jewelry there have apparently been stolen from a display case. Word of the theft comes 2 days after a painting by Renoir was reported stolen from the prestigious museum. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
The curators said the stolen necklaces, bracelets, and earrings date to the 2nd and 3rd century. They said they were lifted by thieves from the Egyptian antiquities section of the museum. The theft was discovered during a security check on Wednesday, shortly after thieves cut a painting by Auguste Renoir out of its frame in the middle of the afternoon. On the same day, two other Paris museums were burglarized. Jacques Salois, head of French museums, said the jewelry theft had occurred long before the painting had been stolen. However, a second theft at Paris's largest museum raises serious questions about the safety of its collection. Salois said the Louvre will remain open with tightened security. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
The Indian government has sent the army to take control of its troubled state of Kashmir. The army and security forces have been given special powers to crush a growing Muslim separatist movement. So far, more than 700 people have died in violence as Muslim militants fight for independence or possible union with Pakistan. The Indian government announced that it will be taking direct control of the region and superseding the state government. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In 1969, David Crosby of the Byrds, Stephen Stills of the Buffalo Springfield, and Graham Nash of the Hollies formed a new group. Their signature was their close harmonies. David Crosby and Graham Nash are my guests today.
Helplessly hoping her harlequin hovers nearby, awaiting a word. Gasping at glimpses of gentle true spirit, he runs, wishing he could fly. Only to trip at the sound of goodbye.
Crosby, Stills, and Nash, sometimes joined by Neil Young, were one of the most popular groups of the late 60s and early 70s. Crosby, Stills, and Nash have performed together on and off for the past 21 years, and each member has recorded solo albums. They have a new album called Live It Up, and they're on a four-month-long concert tour. Crosby was addicted to drugs during much of the 70s and 80s. He kicked cold turkey in 1985 in a Texas prison. I asked him if this tour feels different from other tours because he's straight now.
It's getting to be like my normal state now. I don't even really, I don't even feel so surprised by it anymore. You know, for a long time, it was such an incredible new feeling, you know, that, things were very different. But it's getting to be how I normally approach things now, and I'm getting comfortable with it. And I do think I do a lot better work since I straightened up. I think I got a lot more sensitivity to what I'm doing and to my partners and to the audience, and I know I'm singing better.
And it's certainly a large change from my perspective. Now this aeroplane flies on three engines instead of only two.
Well, were there things that you felt you had to, like, cover up or make up for when David was having drug problems?
It's not a question of covering up. It's a question of rebalancing.
Yeah.
You have to work harder because one of you is not quite there. You have to structure songs so that there's not too many of David's in a row. But all that's over with, and it's water under the bridge.
I want to ask you about the harmonies that you do. I think, like, voices, as you get older, your voice change tends to deepen a little bit. Has that affected, like, where you each sing in the harmonies now or the way you lay out the harmonies?
Not so much how we lay them out. You know, we might not be, you know, by a couple of notes, we might not be quite as ambitious as we were, but Graham has somehow magically retained his ability to sing stratospherically high. And he does so consistently. So the top end of our sound has remained pretty much the same. I've lost a couple of notes with age, but not too many. But then I usually sing the middle part, so it's not really a problem. And Stephen, although he has a falsetto where he can go up pretty high, usually sings the lower part. So we haven't had to compromise much.
If you're just joining us, my guests are David Crosby and Graham Nash, and Crosby, Stills, and Nash have a new record, and the new album is called Live It Up. Let me play something from the new record. Graham, I want to play one of your songs. This is House of Broken Dreams.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if you think of this as a kind of follow-up to Our House.
I didn't until somebody pointed out that it could be the antithesis of that song.
Yeah.
And when I began to look at it from that point of view, I kind of agree with them. Our House has a very rosy future, and House of Broken Dreams has a very dusty end.
Let's listen to it.
Mm-hmm.
where shadows throw shadows on the wall, and memories are mountains to climb, knowing everyone can fall. And here, where the cobwebs count the hours since we let the laughter clear the air, painfully trying to touch, knowing that we used to care. Separate houses, separate hearts. It's hard to face the feelings tearing us apart. In this house of broken dreams, love lies.
House of Broken Dreams, written by Graham Nash from the new Crosby, Stills, and Nash album called Live It Up. The new record is on Atlantic?
Always.
Yeah, well, I had read somewhere, you could tell me this is true, that if this is true, that you're still fulfilling the initial contract to Atlantic Records because you never made as many records as it stipulated in the contract.
We will probably be fulfilling the initial contract to Atlantic sometime in the year 2000.
And the reason why we are with Atlantic is that we have tremendous loyalty to Ahmet Erdogan and Doug Morris. Ahmet has been the man that we signed with in 1969 for six records, which we still have not completed yet. We believe that Ahmet Erdogan is one of the true music people within the music business, a business that has been overrun by lawyers.
But so you still are fulfilling that initial contract in a way?
Well,
right?
Actually, we've rewritten that contract several times since then. So not in technical fact, no, we're not. But in, you know, in a certain sense, yes, we are. And we will probably continue to be. We really... Ahmet's a friend.
Yeah.
He's not, you know, somebody that normally my you know, relationship with record companies would be as an adversary, you know, but Ahmet's a friend.
Is that one of the things that keeps the group together, or is it far beyond that?
It's only one very simple thing that keeps this band together, and that's music. I think that if we didn't make music together, I probably wouldn't speak to Stephen. I would speak to David. He lives 20 seconds away from me. We have breakfast most mornings and hang out. Stephen lives miles away from me. And if we didn't make music, I probably would not maintain my relationship with Stephen. I love him dearly. I love to make music with him. But he can be difficult.
Well, I get the feeling in your own ways, maybe you're all difficult or something. I mean,
I'm sure we are. I'm sure, you know, if you were to ask Stephen,
yeah,
he would probably respond in kind. But... what we have learned to do over the years is to be more cognizant of each other's feelings, more compassionate, more cognizant of our weaknesses and our strengths.
David Crosby, I want to play one of the songs that you wrote for the new album, Live It Up. Would you rather hear Arrows or Yours and Mine? I'm going to leave this one up to you.
Oh, what a terrible choice. I love Arrows because Michael Hedges, and you know who Michael Hedges is, right? He's a wonderful talent, wrote it together. But if I have to choose between the two, let's do Yours and Mine because I think it's about something really important.
You want to say anything about writing it?
I'll tell you how it happened. It was a very good example of helping a song grow. You saw Time magazine a couple of weeks ago, right?
The kid. What was the cover?
The kid with the automatic rifle. 14-year-old boy on the cover with a Colt Armalite rifle. I've seen pictures like that before, and somehow that stuck in my mind as just, you know, a perfect example of wrong. You know, I know that we did something wrong in this world when that kid is standing there with that rifle, you know, and kids younger than that are dying every day in Beirut and in Belfast and even in L.A.
Well, let's hear it.
I can see a boy of 14. He's got a rifle in his hand. He's dying to defend his desert land. He's got an arm around his father, another arm around his gun. Must the child in father die so young? There's a teenage girl in Belfast playing in the street. Her brother plays a different game. around the corner and the power's overseas. And who are they to ruin lives like these?
But they're yours and they're mine. They're yours.
It's Yours and Mine, written by David Crosby from the new Crosby, Stills, and Nash record, Live It Up. And my guests are David Crosby and Graham Nash, and we'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
David Crosby and Graham Nash are my guests. They have a new album, Crosby, Stills, and Nash album called Live It Up. Stephen Stills isn't with us for this interview today. I'd really love to hear the story about how the two of you first met. Is there such a story?
Yes, there is, yeah.
Can you tell it?
The Hollies were in Los Angeles in 1967, maybe even late 66. And I had, on a previous visit, met a woman who drastically changed my life. Her name was Cass Elliott. She was the lead singer with Mamas and the Papas. And on my next visit to L.A., when I was staying at the Knickerbocker, she called me up one day. She said, I want to take you somewhere. Be downstairs in the lobby 5 minutes, which is the way the Cass used to operate the world, you know. Be here, be here, down, be down, be down, be down. So I was down in the lobby, and she rode up in this red convertible Porsche and proceeded to drive me up Laurel Canyon. And windy, 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 and we end up at this house that also has a dark green Porsche. Was it convertible, David?
No.
No, a dark green Porsche in the garage. Led me up the stairs, and I see this man who is lying on a settee with a tray of dope on his chest.
Well, let's be specific now. It was a tray of...
Marijuana.
Marijuana, at the time.
Yeah, that's what we called dope then, in those days. Rolling the most immaculate joints that I've ever seen, that could very well have easily gone into a packet and been sold as, you know, consumer level stuff. And that kind of amazed me because I'd never seen anybody quite do this whilst answering the phone, whilst watching the TV and reading a book at the same time.
Eating too, probably.
Yes, probably. we got on famously. David did not know who I was. But
Cass the Rat didn't tell me who he was.
Was that intentional?
Yeah, sure. She loved to do things like that. She didn't tell me who he was. I really liked this guy, you know, that she brought over. He was totally mystified about who he was. I hadn't the vaguest clue. And then after he was gone, you know, later on, I said, well, who was that guy? And she said, you ever hear King Midas in reverse? And I said, you're kidding, you know. I'm a harmony singer freak. You know, I love harmony singers. You know, I love the Everly Brothers. I love people that can sing great harmony. And the minute you hear a Hollies record, you know, that's what you notice is this fantastic high harmony. And so she told me, I beat her about the head and shoulders for a while and said, I want to see him again.
And that's how David and I met.
So how did you decide to actually perform together? Start singing.
Well, we were friends before we ever got involved in music on that level. We both, of course, knew each other musically, and I was a great fan of his stuff on the Byrds albums. And one day the Byrds were touring England, and David was in London, and I had his number, and he was staying at a hotel that was, strangely enough, called the White House. And I said, hey, you don't want to be at the White House. Blue-haired ladies, old people, cigars.
Pit.
Come over and stay with me. So he came over and stayed with me at my, I had a Muse apartment in London. And then we started to talk music, you know, and he left me with a tape of a very early demo of a song he'd written called Guinevere, and a song he'd written called Deja Vu, and a song he'd written called Wooden Ships. I believe Long Time Gone was on there also. And so, it amazed me that these songs had not been recorded yet, because, you know, in hindsight, they were brilliant songs. And so from the very first musical inklings of this man, of this mass complex man that Crosby is, I began to realize that I would like to make music with this man, that he wrote and thought very differently than me. And yet there was something that bound us together, either our sense of humor or our sense of the ridiculous or our sense of rebellion. There was something that linked David and I together from the very beginning, and it remains to this day.
Were there things you wanted to each do that you couldn't do with the bands that you were with, that Graham Nash you couldn't do with the Hollies?
Obviously.
That David Crosby you couldn't do with the Byrds?
Yeah. I'm not as sure now as I was then that I was being held back by the situation I was in, but I was certainly stuck in a role. I was, you know, the rhythm guitar player, harmony singer, and it was tough for me to be recognized as a singer-songwriter in my own right in that band and in that role. And I know that it was even more so for Graham. Graham was writing songs that absolutely stunned me. They were so good. And his band wanted to do an album of Dylan songs. And if I think...
Which is not necessarily bad, but they wanted to do it Las Vegas style.
Well, no, I really think, actually, the Hollies doing Dylan is like... really inappropriate
choice.
I'm
trying to be kind.
I'm trying to be kind, too.
Well, the Hollies have such great records. I mean, like, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
They make great records, yeah. But a Dylan song is not the thing
for them to be doing.
Not at all. Not even close. Not in the ballpark. And they had great songs, his songs. So I know that he was, you know, frustrated, too. And then my relationship with the Byrds came to, a feisty end between me and them, and they threw me out, and I started hanging around with Steven, and then we, you know, lucked into, you know, singing together. And the minute you sing together and hear that sound, you know you want to do that, obviously.
Now I want to get back, Graham Nash, to your work with the Hollies. Now you were writing, I mean, what I think was like great songs like Stop, Stop, Stop and Carrie Ann. I mean, did you feel like that was a kind of pop that you didn't want to do anymore?
It became so after a while. You know, we were trained to write, you know. I don't think we ever wrote anything over 2 minutes and 50 seconds long.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was a Tin Pan Alley kind of training that we went through in the late 50s, early 60s. And that's what I was kind of stuck in. But then having met David and Steven and expanded my awareness, not only on a personal level, but on by smoking huge, copious amounts of marijuana, I began to change the way I felt about what was important in music. And I began to realize that the three-minute pop song, although it has its value, was not truly, truly important on a deep level. And so I began to write songs that I personally thought that were better songs than just three-minute pop songs. And the Hollies were not interested in those songs. And so I began to question myself. I thought that it was me that was at fault, that I was wrong, that, you know, because there were four of them and only one of me. It was Crosby that saved my musical life by saying, wait a second, if you're crazy, then I'm just as crazy. And maybe we should stick together here.
Were the other people in the Hollies, were the other musicians, like, not getting high when you had started getting high?
Not at all.
Did that?
They were drinkers.
So that kind of represented a shift in sensibility for you?
Very much so. The gap widened as we were looking at the situation. It was just getting wider and wider and wider. And then when Cass turned me onto LSD, it got even wider. And so at a certain point, I just couldn't relate, you know?
So you quit the group?
Yeah.
Was there hostility when you quit, I mean?
Great deal of it. There's still hostility to this man to this day. And I'm pointing at David.
I came over to England and said, psst, hey, psst, come with me. And they saw me do it. I don't think they'll ever forget
me. I remember
the
moment of the last Hollies concert at the London Palladium, which was a benefit for Princess Margaret's Save the Children Fund. And David came to visit us. And he came resplendent in a brown, beautiful three-piece Victorian suit, his velvet hat, and a silver-tipped cane.
Were there differences in how you approached the music business? David Crosby coming from America, Graham Nash coming from England. I mean, there's some differences.
We did have some differences about how we related to the music business when we originally got together. I had already gotten to a place where, for my way of thinking, the music business and the music press and all were adversaries. But I had been watching Dylan. See, I used to go and go to press conferences with Bob Dylan and watch him, you know, play verbal ping pong with these people. And so then when I came to England, I had this enormous amount of irreverence, you know, for it. And I think Graham liked that.
I did.
He was really tired of having
to understand. David came to one of the Hollies press conferences in London. And the Hollies, because we were, you know, controlled by the forces that made pop groups, and we wanted to be famous and all that stuff, you know, people would say, okay, all stand on your heads now. Okay, click, click, click. Good. Okay, now take this orange in your hand and juggle with it. Fine. Click, 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 click. We went to a press conference and somebody asked me a question and Crosby stood in the way and he said, screw off. We're not answering that question, are we, Graham? Now, this shocked me because we'd been used to treating the press like gods. And here is someone who treated them, you know, like dogs, which is almost spelt the same way, but not quite, you know. So, it was amazing.
So did that become a habit of yours afterwards? Or?
No, I still have more patience with people in the press. David still is irreverent.
I'd love for you to each, like, update your stories for us now to tell us, like, where you live approximately, not the address or anything, and if you're married, if
All
you
right.
have kids.
All right, let me start. I've been married to the same woman for 15 years.
Long
I married
time?
Her twice.
What, really?
We have, only because I remarried, not because I divorced and married again.
Oh, it was like one of these renewal
yes,
things?
Yes, yeah. On the same day that David and Jan got married. Susan and I redid our vows. Oh. I have three children, Jackson, Willie, John, and Niall, 12, 10, and 8, respectively. I spend my time between Los Angeles and Hawaii, and I have a million things that I'm doing.
David Crosby, can you update your story for us?
Sure. Let's see. I also am married. I've been married, what, about 3 years now?
To someone you've been with
to
a very long time.
To somebody that I've been with for 13 years, Jan. And very happy.
One of the sweetest people I know.
Yeah, she is a gem. And we live about 50 yards from Graham and Susan. And our lives have gone through such a traumatic scene in the last, you know, 12 years or so. Having, you know, managed to, you know, kick drugs and get straight, we're like a pair of kids, you know. We wander around and everything is fun for us. Every day that we're alive is like Christmas.
David Crosby and Graham Nash. Crosby, Stills, and Nash have a new record called Live It Up. They're currently on a 4-month tour that will take them to more than 70 cities, including Philadelphia, Boston, Chicago, Denver, and Los Angeles. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, folklorist Alan Lomax. In the 1930s, he and his father, John Lomax, were the first to do field recordings of American folk music with a portable recording machine. Alan Lomax has produced a new series on American regional music for PBS called American Patchwork. Here's more from the new album by Crosby, Stills, and Nash.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
Tommy Davidson does impressions of Michael Jackson and Anita Baker in his comedy act, and he's done Sugar Ray Leonard on the Fox TV series In Living Color. Coming up, we meet one of today's rising young comics. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album from Jeff Lynne. Lynne was the guiding force behind the Electric Light Orchestra, a member of the Traveling Wilburys, and he's an accomplished record producer. Now, Ken says, Lynne's reinvented himself as a solo artist. And once again, Madison Avenue has shown us there's nothing that can't be turned into a marketing ploy. Leslie Savin takes a look at how some companies are using the end of the Cold War as a way to sell their products. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. At today's Kremlin meeting of the Soviet Party Congress, Boris Yeltsin issued a stinging attack on party conservatives. He urged the delegates to change the party's name and warned that the communists risk a population overthrow if changes are not made. Benjamin Rowan, Moscow, has more.
Yeltsin's speech to the conservative-dominated Congress was frank, forceful, and unabashedly radical. He told the delegates that the party must make urgent changes or it would cease to be a political force in the country. Yeltsin added that the Congress could only control the destiny of the party, not the future of perestroika. He urged members to change the party's name to the Party of Democratic Socialism, abolish party cells in the military and state institutions, and offer up competing platforms to the vote of the party rank and file. Yeltsin said the changes needed to come quickly. Any attempt to delay the course of events will lead to a historic defeat, he warned, suggesting that the Communist Party's property could be nationalized and the party's leaders brought to trial. For National Public Radio, I'm Benjamin Rowe in Moscow.
In London, NATO allies have agreed to sharply cut defense forces in Europe and at the same time extend a hand of friendship to Soviet leader Gorbachev and the rest of Eastern Europe. A joint statement says the 16 nations will never in any circumstance be the first to use force. In Moscow, Gorbachev said that he is ready to accept a NATO invitation to address a meeting of the Western Alliance probably in December. In this country, the death toll now stands at 17 in the explosion and fire that ripped through an Arco plant east of Houston, Texas. The cause of the blast is still under investigation. Lance Smith of member station KUHF in Houston reports.
Harris County arson investigators say of the 17 dead workers, 5 worked for Arco, 11 were employed by Austin Industrial, a maintenance contractor, and one body was found in the cab of a vacuum truck. Plant manager Earl McCallop says the investigation is focusing on a giant compressor that feeds gases through a pipeline near a wastewater tank that exploded.
They were not cleaning out the tank. The tank was in operation. We think that there was some maintenance activities going on at the tank involving a compressor. Okay. There was no one inside the tank.
Occupational Safety and Health Administration officials are at the plant site. The coroner has yet to identify the bodies. For National Public Radio, I'm Lance Smith in Houston.
U.S. Treasury bond prices fell sharply today after unemployment figures were announced that gave little encouragement for lower interest rates. Unemployment dropped to 5.2% in June from 5.3% in May. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up almost 26 points to close at 2,904.95. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. The career of rock and roll singer and producer Jeff Lynne has taken a couple of different turns. First, he was with the Electric Light Orchestra, then the Traveling Wilburys. Now Lynne's got his first solo album. Rock critic Ken Tucker has this review of Armchair Theater.
When he was guiding the Electric Light Orchestra, Jeff Lynne was a chilly, forbidding artist, a control freak who never let himself get freaky. At first, Roy Wood was in the band to supply some eccentricity and oddness, but after he left, Jeff Lynne began to grind out one sterile hit single after another. You assume that's what Lynne always wanted to do, but these days he's giving interviews saying he soon felt trapped by the star machinery of ELO's success, that what he really wanted to do was make simpler, more personal music. But I wouldn't believe a word of it if Lynn hadn't put out Armchair Theater, a solo album that does nothing less than reinvent him as a musician.
Love is what I want. Oh, yeah. And all you gotta do is bring it to me, baby. Talk is what I
On Armchair Theater, Jeff Lynne has brought to his own music the lessons he recently learned as a member of the Traveling Wilburys and as the producer on Tom Petty's wonderful Full Moon Fever album. Foremost among these lessons is the idea that roughness can be a virtue and that using studio technology to achieve an unfinished, cobbled-together effect can not only be charming, but moving.
Don't say goodbye. Don't even think about it.
Armchair Theater isn't a flawless album. Jeff Lynne's cover of the old Jesse Stone rocker Don't Let Go is stiff, and his versions of the pop standards Stormy Weather and September Song are just painfully sincere. But the rest of the album is completely beguiling, reaching its high point right at the beginning with a song called Every Little Thing. I think Every Little Thing is staggering, a history of essential rock riffs in just under 4 minutes, and the most honest tribute to Motown a white musician has ever achieved. Listening to Armchair Theater, you get the feeling that Jeff Lynne has learned how to let loose creatively, while at the same time sounding more relaxed. He's chosen to reveal some warmth underneath all those layered vocals and those one-man band overdubbed instrumental tracks. To cash in on Lynne's recent prominence as a Wilbury, Epic Records is putting out Afterglow, a collection of the best of ELO. There you will hear Jeff Lynne's craft and craftiness. You have to get Armchair Theater, however, to hear Jeff Lynne's personality and openness.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly.
In my heart, you were the one. But now you're gone. Your photograph brings back sweet memories.
your face so young, the days so long, but now you're gone.
This is Fresh Air. You can see my guest Tommy Davidson doing sketch comedy Sunday nights on the Fox TV series In Living Color. He's one of the actors who's not part of the Wayans family. Keenan Ivory Wayans produces the hit program and stars in it, along with his brothers Damon and SW1 and sister Kim. Tommy Davidson started doing stand-up 3 years ago and has since opened for performers like Anita Baker, Al Jarreau, and Patti LaBelle. He has his own comedy special that will be shown on Showtime this month. One of Davidson's trademarks is his impressions of singers like Michael Jackson, Lionel Richie, Stevie Wonder, and Michael McDonald.
But the great thing about music is that everybody got their own style. Michael McDonald, he got his own style. I can't understand a word, but he's bad. Girl, don't worry.
Well, some of the people who you parody are people who you used to open for, like Anita Baker. Did you used to do her in your act when you were opening for her? Yeah, I can imagine.
No, that's not a smart thing to do, is do an impression of somebody on their show. And, you know, unless, of course, you do it in good taste. Like I did Al Jarreau when I was with Al Jarreau. And I set it up really good. I said if anybody in the audience has enough money to go and see this guy, you should, because he's really talented. Then I did an impression of him. And so it was kind of flattering.
Now, you're a trained singer, right?
Not trained.
Okay.
Well, I guess hands-on trained.
Hey, right.
Not trained in the technical sense.
What kind of singing did you do before doing comedy?
Soul. I did a lot of soul singing
when
I was little. And I started out going to talent shows and stuff. I was like a little protege. I won all the talent shows up until I was around 13. Then I started doing what everybody else wanted to do, like play football and basketball and stuff.
You're one of the stars of In Living Color. How did you get the part on the show? How did you get to be in the group on the show?
I was very fortunate. I auditioned for the show during a stand-up act, and then they had me come in and do some improv with the casting director and Keenan himself, along with another producer. And obviously they thought I did well. I didn't know how I felt when I left there, but I got the part, and I was really happy.
What did you do in the audition?
He asked me to play different things. I don't even really remember particularly, but he would say, okay, now you're a cab driver. This guy just got in your cab. He just robbed the bank. Now do play that. And you would have to play whatever he gave to you.
Do you get to write sketches yourself on the show? Are you one of the writers?
No, I'm not one of the writers, but I do get to have an influence on the bits and the skits that I do, as well as ones that I don't. It's a really open atmosphere where we're able to say, well, I think that this will work, or I think that will work, or why don't you try this, and why don't you try that? Always doesn't necessarily work, but they're open to hear that.
Of the sketches that you've been in, which one has gotten the most mail?
I don't know, because I haven't got all that much mail, but I know the one that has gotten the most reaction is the Sugar Ray Leonard thing. Everybody seems to like that Sugar Ray Leonard thing that I've done.
You want to describe it?
It's just, there was two of them. There was one where I was commenting on the show. And I was scoring the show, so I was doing Sugar Ray scoring the show, and he's going, I think so far the show is very, very good. As you can see, the audience has been applauding at every one of the skits. That shows that the cast has been giving them everything they want. And then we did another one called Three Champs and a Baby, where it was Mike Tyson, Ali, and Sugar Ray Leonard. And it was a takeoff of Three Men and a Baby. So that worked really good.
Were there many blacks on TV when you were growing up?
Not really. There was, let me see, Rodney Allen Rippey.
Wait, what's that? This must
Jack
be
Jack in the Box commercials.
Oh, okay.
In Room 222, there were a couple of blacks in that.
Mm-hmm.
Not that many. No, they weren't. There was like one on every show, like Link from the Mod Squad, and
right.
Bill Cosby on I Spy. You know, there was one on Mission Impossible, who never said nothing. You know, so you know, there weren't a lot of blacks on TV.
Were there TV roles that you tried out for before landing a part in Living Color?
Yeah, like a million. Gosh. Well, not actually that many, but I did a pilot for Paramount Television, which was an adaptation from Coming to America, the movie.
Eddie Murphy's movie, yeah.
Right. And I got the part for that, and it was a pilot, but it didn't go anywhere. It didn't fly.
Who would you have played?
I would have played the lead. I did play the lead in the pilot. I was Eddie Murphy's little brother who comes to America, but the writing sucked.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so it hurt the project.
Well, did you know that when you were doing it? Did you feel the writing was under par?
Yeah, and I did as much as I could. I gave them so many ideas and so many things that I wanted to do to make the show funnier, and they said, nah, do what the writer says, and the show suffered for that.
Now, where did you grow up?
I grew up in D.C., Washington, D.C.
Now, I know that you started to perform in a topless club. Is that right, the first time you did comedy?
Yeah, that's true.
How did you get to start there?
Well, a friend of mine asked me to try it. He had been asking me to try comedy for quite some time, and I wasn't interested in comedy. I didn't want to do comedy. I wanted to sing. I love music. And one night, you know, his band played for the girls, and they had a 15-minute break. This was years later, of course. And he asked me if I wanted to try my comedy, and I tried it. And it worked. And ever since then, I've been doing it. So that's where I started.
Now, what made him think that you should be in comedy?
Because I used to make him laugh all the time.
Uh-huh.
And he just thought that I could do it. He said, I know you can do it.
You came of age with rap music, right?
Yeah.
What what effect did that have on you, especially as a singer? Because in rap, like, you don't necessarily have to sing.
Right. It had a good effect on me. At one time, I wanted to do that. I wanted to rap. I went through the whole rapping phase. But rapping, the reason why rapping's been around so long is because it's been through certain metamorphoses, you know? Back when I was coming up, I mean, I first heard my first rapping record in 1977. You know, 1976, and that was a long time ago, and the form was different. Now the form seems to be a lot more progressive. The rappers seem to be using a lot larger words and different kind of rhythms. I mean, rap is really a progressive form, and people think just because it's not singing that it's not music. You know, they say, well, rapping isn't, and it's not singing, but it is an art form that is, I think it's, I don't think it's that difficult to do, but you have to be skilled to do it, you know?
So you tried it? You tried rapping?
Yeah.
How were you?
I thought it was pretty good. I could be a rapper now. I think it's pretty easy because I'm good with words and I'm good with rhythm. So I could probably do it. It's just not my style of music, that's all.
Did you ever have a rapper's name?
Yeah, Tom Ski.
How do you get names? I mean, I've really never understood how rappers choose their names.
I don't know. I don't know how they get their names, but they all seem to be kind of like in the same vein, like MC Hammer, MC Eric B, and Rakim. And, you know, they all have the same sort of, it's a style. It's a certain style. The rap is very stylized. Rap is its own thing.
So how did you choose your name?
There was a guy named Starsky back in the 70s. That I liked a lot, so I just named my name after Starsky, and I named my name Tomsky.
This is like a real Starsky or a TV Starsky?
Nah, the real Starsky. DJ Starsky was his name.
Well, you have a nice send-up of rap in your show on Showtime.
Oh, yeah, that's the impression of the national anthem.
Exactly,
in rap form, yeah.
But you can do all the scratching and everything just with your voice.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's pretty good. Do you turn to your childhood for a lot of material?
Yeah.
What kind of childhood did you have? What kind of neighborhood did you grow up in?
I grew up in a good neighborhood. A lot of bad things happened in my neighborhood, but it was a good neighborhood. It was a multi-ethnic neighborhood, black, white, Spanish, Asian, African. It was a very multicultural place. It was predominantly black, though. And it was a good, fruitful environment for me. It was a lot of kids in the neighborhood, and we did a lot of fun things. We got in a lot of trouble coming up and all that stuff.
What are some of the things you got into trouble for?
Breaking into people's houses, throwing rocks, knocking down trash cans, stuff like that. Stealing bicycles.
What got you out of doing that?
Work. I started working on a job. That's what really got me out of it. I could have very well went the other way with the crime and all that stuff, but I had a lot of good people influencing me. My mother was a good influence, and she let me know that you never give up. You know, for those of you who have children, don't ever give up on your child. And a lot of people, you know, I work with, and I was just fortunate to run into a lot of positive people. And it's the people that you run into and the influences that you're influenced by that make you the person that you are.
So what got you into doing that in the first place?
It was just the environment. It was just wanting to be a part of the, you know, wanting to be a part of the gang, and it's just the way that, you know, it's the way that I grew up.
So how do you use that in your performances now? Like the knowledge that you have about how and why people break into homes and things like that?
Well, that was just a certain period in my life. And that was just, I guess it was just a negative part of me, you know, and I don't really focus on that in my act because of that, you know. So it's not like I say, you know, I used to break into houses and blah, blah, this, blah, blah, that, blah, blah, that. You know, that was just something that happened. And, you know, I move on. You make mistakes as you grow up and you move on.
So who are you working on perfecting now?
Somebody different every day.
Right.
Somebody different every day. I don't know. I think I just want a surprise.
Okay. Thanks so much for talking with us.
All right. Thanks for having me.
You can see Tommy Davidson Sunday nights on In Living Color. He performs this weekend at Caroline's in New York, and his comedy special can be seen on Showtime July 7th, 12th, 20th, and 29th.
DJ! 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 Say! 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 Say, can you see it? Say, can you see it?
This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. We'll have a report from London today at the NATO summit about the new ideas for the Atlantic Alliance, also some new ideas for the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. Boris Yeltsin, the premier of the Russian Republic, suggests the party begin by changing its name. And we'll also have a report by John Burnett about the governor of Louisiana's veto of that state's new abortion law. It would be the toughest anti-abortion law passed anywhere in the country. It has been vetoed. However, there are so many supporters of the bill in the Louisiana legislature that it's possible the veto could be overridden.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Western political leaders have just finished meeting in London to figure out how to incorporate the changing Eastern Bloc into the NATO alliance. But commentator Leslie Savin suggests that Madison Avenue has already figured out where Eastern Europe and Asia fit in American sales pitches.
The vernacular of East-West freedom continues to evolve, coddling and cooing us into a braver, newer world. GE's latest We Bring Good Things to Life commercial is so brazen that it begs our cynicism. But damn if those production values, the very showcase of capitalism, don't seduce.
Freedom is all that matters. Freedom is everything.
There's a new light shining over Eastern Europe.
You know, the Hungarians are waiting for a very long time.
A light of hope, joy, and most of all, a new light of freedom.
Everything is changing. It's wonderful.
It's a miracle.
I'm so happy.
And in this spirit, GE has entered into an historic partnership with a company called Tungsram, Hungary's leading lighting company.
Freedom is something that you have to work for very hard.
It's like a dream.
A beautiful dream. It's a miracle. I feel young again. In other words, the good things. Ostensibly, GE made this 60-second extravaganza to announce its partnership with Tungsram, what GE calls Hungary's leading lighting company. In fact, it's Hungary's only lighting company, and last fall, GE gained controlling interest in it. On the final crescendo of Liszt's Hungarian Rhapsody, we see hundreds of countrymen raise their candles in a grand salute, not to their hard-won freedom, but to the conquering sponsor. Those candles make 1,000 points. Rescuing our new Hungarian friends from the darkness of socialism, the flickering flames align them with private sector volunteerism, if not also with President Bush's predecessor, former GE spokesman Ronald Reagan. The wax also serves as a primitive counterpoint to all those West is best bulbs, a sly suggestion as to just how those Hungarians would be reading their Wall Street journals if GE wasn't there lighting the way. GE is an odd one to pocket coins behind the Iron Curtain. A group called InFact is leading a boycott to protest General Electric's massive role in the production of nuclear weapons. As InFact's executive director says, GE's making profits off both ends, lobbying for a defense contract to maintain the Cold War and benefiting from the thaw in the Cold War. GE may have brought freedom to Eastern Europe, but Kentucky Fried Chicken brought Eastern Europeans here to foster a much more important freedom, the freedom to eat cholesterol. In a 30-second spot which ran this spring, a hefty Russian babushka is hardly off the plane when her slimmer U.S. relatives haul her off to a mall. Her eyes pop out at all the shiny objects. She trashes her old lady shoes for some Reeboks. But she doesn't quite get this freedom thing until she chomps into a Kentucky Fried Chicken drumstick.
Welcome to Kentucky Fried Chicken. You ought to try a whole meal.
She'll take it.
Today, Lisa Vinichenko is getting her first taste of America.
American health consciousness demands that we shun fried foods. But deprived for so long, our Russian grandmother appreciates the grease. Who are we to turn up our noses? We're starting to see how corporate America is packaging the fall of communism in ever more subtle wrappings. It's presented not merely as the validation of capitalism, but the people of the bloc also serve as our newest role models. In their cute, pathetic little ways, of course. Just as they yearn to return to their pre-red lifestyles, we yearn to return to our Donna Reed America, when the world was even safer for corporate profits.
Leslie Savin writes about advertising for The Village Voice. Our interviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Joan Tuohy. Naomi Person produces our reviews and commentaries. Roberta Shurrock and Allison Dufty are our production assistants. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, folklorist Alan Lomax tells us about his new public television series on America's regional music and culture. And we go back to his early work recording the stories and songs of Leadbelly, Woody Guthrie, and Jelly Roll Morton. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.